All right, hello. Go around and say hi to everybody. Starting with Linda B and Paul, Mark, Susan, Paulette, Jeff, Shoketsu, Bob K. Franklin, Marv, Grant, Gaffel, Mick, Tyler, Aaron, Katie, Alice, Sabrina, Ruth Ann, and I don't think she can hear me yet, but Linda R. Hello. Announcements in just about a month. We will have our Jukai ceremony on Sunday, I think it's June 27th. Bob and I managed to get, well, we didn't. We managed to arrange internet connection at the Zendo this Monday, so we'll still be working out how that'll all work, but the plan is to have a small in-person Jukai ceremony for those who are coming, and but then of course then we'll have it hooked up remotely as well, because there are some of you who are taking the precepts from afar and others of you who just can be there to witness. So that will be on that Sunday. We'll have normal sitting and chanting, and then the ceremony will happen essentially when Dharma talk would ordinarily happen. And then those of you who are local, I do want to plan something, some kind of in-person picnicky celebration or something afterwards, because Mick and Ellen will be flying in, and we should, show our faces if we're here so they can meet a few of us. And then, save the date for the August session. I think it's Monday evening, the 23rd through Saturday morning, the 28th. And again, if things go according to plan, we'll have in person the opportunity to participate in person if you're fully vaccinated by that point, but also online opportunity, whether you are local or far away, you can participate online. Anything else that I should mention or any questions? All right. So tonight, it's the precept, do not dwell on past mistakes, create wisdom from ignorance, and we are being led by Franklin. So take it away,
Yes.
Franklin.
Okay. Well, first off, Domio, if you don't mind, maybe you can help me manage the questions in particular, and any kind of discussion activity would be really useful for me. Then I don't have to worry about that part of it.
Okay, will do.
Cool. All right, I guess we'll just get started. My hope is that we do create some discussion and some questions. Otherwise, this could be very short. but as it stands, I think there's enough here to hopefully generate that. So we'll see. Anyway, I just wanted to start off and talk a little bit personally about all this. So my confession right now is I'm not a particularly what I would call devout Zen practitioner. I'm not particularly well read, and I also find that my practice tends to wax and wane, and I find that sesshin is really useful for me, as is the term student activities, because those tend to help me devote a certain amount of energy towards my practice. And otherwise, it can sort of go by the wayside and a little bit. I do often find Buddhist and Zen text in particular somewhat confusing and contradictory. Sometimes I get this idea that Dogen is from another planet, and Zen is a kind of a fun little joke imposed upon us by the aliens from whatever planet he is from. But I'm assuming he's from Earth, and you know, there is a long and complex string of cause and effect from his world to ours, which I can't pretend to totally understand. In addition to all the cultural differences we often note between East and West, you know, there's the distance of time between then and now, and then there's the physical distance between cultures that gave this kind of uniqueness in those days that we don't experience today. And then of course there's problems of translation and all that kind of stuff, which I won't get into that. All this seems to imply that practice, you know, that the truth of Zen is not going to be found directly, necessarily completely through the text by itself. And that's okay, I think. At some level, I think the text could be read like poetry, and I think Domio's pointed this out before, and that the meaning can be filtered through your own experience. And so that's how I often read the text and experience that kind of thing. So this is what kind of, this kind of confounds me, but at the same time, it's what draws me in. I guess there's much more than like my relative self can really comprehend, and that my brain was blessed with, you know, that it's impossible for my own brain to kind of unify this comprehensive idea of relative and absolute. So that means that there's something external to that that can only be, I guess, done through experience. And, you know, memorizing Dogen is probably not going to do it. There's something deeper and something more profound than this sort of intellectual truth. And this is a really hard place to find, to access, I think, at least for me. You know, every once in a while I get little glimpses of it, and it's pretty unpredictable as to when that happens. On a good day, I can find that exhilarating, like this notion of the ephemeral is great and inspirational. I can feel like the ineffable is almost kind of like right there, and I can almost touch it. On a bad day, I think Zen speaks in riddles, and it's just kind of a deliberate attempt to mess with my own mind personally. On an average day, I try to remember that the words are just a means of pointing at something, and pointing at the moon, as the expression goes. And then I try to get practical, which is where I think the precepts and the Eightfold Path can come in. Besides acknowledging the ineffable, an important part of Zen and Buddhism is the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths and the very practical application of their ramifications. I really like how Buddha never really personifies the ineffable, but he just kind of gets down to practical matters of living. He never really asks that you just take things as a matter of faith, but rather that you explore and experiment yourself. In a way, Buddhism helps to give me a worldview or kind of a psychological framework within which to live or to carry out my daily life. In a practical sense, acceptance of self and others and loosening the grip of ego have been very helpful in my life, especially in the last few years. And then finally, a theme I want to kind of hopefully touch on in this is how Buddhism and the sixth precept, the one I'm talking about tonight, relates to some of our hardwired human tendencies. By hardwired, I mean the selective aspects of our human behavior and psychology that have more or less evolved to help guarantee our survival as a species. These behavioral tendencies are both in ways we process the world individually, but also in the context of kind of our social environment or social situation that we're in or that we identify with. So I'm a big fan of, I guess, evolutionary psychology, and hopefully we can look a little bit at that as well. So that's my preamble. And I guess now, you know, the next part of what I want to talk about is just like kind of the definitions out there. There are quite a few actual different views of what this precept really is about. But before I do that, I guess, does anybody want to have any comments just off the start? Okay. Yeah, so like I said, the first thing I did was when I started looking at this was I, of course, Googled. And there are a number of descriptions out there. And so I'm kind of going to run through some of these and then see like what resonates with people. And hopefully we can create a little bit of a discussion around that. So I started, of course, where everyone starts, besides Brightway, is Wikipedia. And it seems that the precepts came from the Brahmajahala, I'm not reading this very well, Sutra, which is otherwise known as Brahma's net. I guess there were 48 lesser precepts and the 10 greater ones, which have since morphed into the 10 grave precepts. At the time, these were designed for the monks in the context of the monastery. And I think these came around somewhere around 500 CE, roughly, maybe. I'm sure Dongren knows the exact dates, so don't quote me on that. In addition to the goal of becoming a bodhisattva through these precepts, they had a really practical application in, you know, minimizing the strife between the monks, and so they could essentially coexist, because when you're a monk, apparently you have a lot of free time to get into trouble. So from Wikipedia, the I'm just going to say the sutra says not to broadcast the misdeeds or faults of the Buddhist assembly, nor encourage others to do so. So and then it goes into more detail in a later section. It says, a disciple of the Buddha must not himself broadcast the misdeeds or infractions of bodhisattva clerics or bodhisattva laypersons or of ordinary monks and nuns, nor encourage others to do so. He must not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of discussing the offenses of the assembly. As a Buddha's disciple, whenever he hears evil persons, externalists, or followers of the two vehicles speak of practices contrary to the Dharma or contrary to the precepts within the Buddhist community, he should instruct them with a compassionate mind and lead them to develop wholesome faith in the Mahayana. If instead he discusses the faults and misdeeds that occur within the assembly, he commits a parajika offense. So from my interpretation of that, I mean, it clearly seems that it's about keeping things within, right? Like almost like the Las Vegas rule, what happens in monastery stays in monastery, right? It's kind of interesting that I'm reading this as like, don't broadcast our stuff, our dirty laundry. So that's kind of like the core of this. And of course, as you can tell, this precept has evolved over time. And I'm going to probably cover a few of the more modern interpretations of it. And what I found is, you know, Brightway has kind of an interesting slant, or I guess the Soto Zen tradition came from Dharma Rain. And then before that, I suppose San Francisco. But And most of them talk about, you know, not speaking in a slanderous way, and you know, we'll see how that all plays out. But ours is a little different because it really talks explicitly about not dwelling on past mistakes and creating wisdom for ignorance. And of course, and to continue, it says, in the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Do not engage in fault finding. Do not condone haphazard talk. So the last sentence is the one the one that most of the interpretations are that I've stumbled across, you know, about haphazard talk sort of center around that, whereas we seem to kind of flip that around a little bit. And I like that we do. I want to segue into a quote from Norman Fisher, where he says, when we see our mistakes, we don't justify or deny. Regret and remorse keep me honest, which leads to repentance and includes apologies, making amends if possible. But there's a big difference in regret for a harmful action versus the conclusion that we are inherently bad people, fated to doing bad things. So Fisher makes the distinction between accountability and remorse, essentially guilt versus the core belief of being flawed or inherently bad. Otherwise, what might be called, in my mind, shame. The distinction can be subtle, but I think it's super important. Guilt is usually, I guess, tethered to some kind of event or something a mistake that you've made. Shame is typically untethered to anything specific, although maybe it's rooted in something specific. But it's the sense of belief that badness is not associated with an event, but is insidious and is part of how we kind of identify with ourselves. And it can crop up at inopportune times, I think. It can make us overly aggressive. It can make us defensive. And so I think when we, and I can speak for myself, when shame is activated, it can be a real thing to struggle with, and it can really affect how we proceed in the world. For me, the only antidote I have found to deal with shame when it's activated in this way is self-compassion. And it is in being patient with myself and not being overly critical and really practicing self-forgiveness. And so Zen has really helped me in that area a lot, actually. It's helped me open up that whole space to allow that to come in. So I guess I was going to take a little stop right here and then just talk about like what people think about this idea of guilt versus shame, or what Fisher had to say, or anything in this particular area that might be worth discussing with regards to mistakes, I think, and how this precept talks about mistakes.
Mick?
Hi. Yeah. One of the things that I think is really interesting about kind of like where I find the intersection of this precept and sort of like some of the more pure elements of my practice is I feel like one of the main reasons I find myself dwelling on mistakes or feeling shamed or angry about my past mistakes tend to be that I get really defensive about my narratives. And when I do something that counters those narratives, it really like this precept invests me in it. I'll give you an example. So I'm a teacher and, you know, hey man, some days as a teacher, you're just not feeling it. And like, it's painful because the class of high school students that are there, they are just clearly not interested. And you just like get your way through it. And then, you know, afterwards I'll be thinking like, man, I should have done better, should have done this, should have done that, should have done that. Because to my mind, I have this narrative that like, I'm a good teacher. But really all that narrative is doing is it's like bumping up. Every time I make a mistake, I have to reconcile this narrative I have about being a good teacher and a mistake that I made. And that narrative, because it's there, forces me to dwell on these past mistakes. And what I'm trying to, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think the precept, the way that I see it, is trying to teach me that like, you don't need those narratives and the past mistakes that you have, those are you, and you don't need to push them away or like try to explain them out. They just are. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but
yeah, I think it does. And actually there's a section I think coming up in what I've prepared that's going to kind of talk a little bit about that, this idea of, I won't get into it yet. There's a couple more questions. So, Mark, I think you were next.
Yeah, I think this is different enough from what Mick said to be worth saying. But for me, when I look in this precept, the first time I looked at it, it always felt like there was a contradiction there, right? There's do not dwell on past mistakes, and then there's create wisdom from ignorance. And part of me wants to say, well, what do you think I'm doing when I dwell on past mistakes? And when I dug into this, I found that one of the sad things about it is when I dwell on past mistakes, I'm not really creating wisdom from ignorance. I'm just banging my head against the fact that the past is irrevocable and mistaking it for the fact that I am irrevocably that person. Right. So when I break this precept, it's because I've lost track of the fact that the vital moment is here and now and choices are being made now. And so that's how I resolved what seemed to be a contradiction in there for me between wisdom and dwelling.
Yeah, I like that. Paulette?
Yeah. So I guess I'm talking a little bit based on what Mark said, but the idea that life is impermanent, so if we made mistakes, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to learn from them, but if we dwell on them, you know, it's that moment is gone. So there's, you know, we're on to the next moment. Sorry.
Right. No, that makes sense.
My cat has something to say about it too. So anyway.
Yeah, it reminds me, I don't know why this came to mind, but the expression, you know, beating a dead horse, right? Like it's a horrible expression. Like who would beat a dead horse? But it's sort of the same thing in a way, right? It's like this idea that we just keep remunerating over the same thing, you know, and I hear what you're saying about that. Cool. All right. Let's see if I can, I might have turned my light on. Give me a sec. I can't see anymore. Okay, so in another section, I think Brightway, Zomio writes about, and a similar take on what I already said, but create wisdom from ignorance. We may be doing this in our minds. However, in this moment, we are not making mistakes. Over time, we become more identified with this body here and now, which is not defined by past mistakes. So I think people that have spoke so far kind of have alluded to this, and it makes me wonder, you know, when we identify a mistake, that's always in context, I think, almost, and I'm trying to think if there's ever a time when it's not this way. it's almost like a retroactive analysis, right? Like, can we ever really make a mistake in the present moment? Is that even possible? You know, aren't all mistakes perceived within, you know, our own incomplete perception of cause and effect? In other words, we have some sort of expectation or some story, and we look at what something that happened in the past, and it somehow doesn't align with this expectation, story that we've created, this narrative. And so then we say it's a mistake. But who's to say, really? You know, I mean, I think there's some obvious things maybe, and there's some gray area here, and it's a spectrum, I think, where clearly if we do a certain kind of grave event, like we hurt someone, right? I mean, I think we can say that's a mistake, but there is a lot of subtlety in there once we get past these sort of more subtle things, I guess. So I think it's really interesting to think about mistakes with regards to the past, you know, and how we interpret the past and how much we decide to forget about the present moment, which I think people have talked to a little bit about. So the last thing I wrote here is, aren't all mistakes essentially judgments about how our preconceived stories didn't turn out? It's kind of an interesting thought to me anyway. So moving on, there's a lot of different takes on what this precept is, at least the description of it. And I'm gonna just go through a few of them, and then if anybody, you know, wants to stop at any point, I'll try to create opportunity to say some comment on these, but keep in mind which ones resonate with you if you can, and maybe we can talk about that later. So Zen Mountain Monastery says, see the perfection, do not speak of others' errors and faults. San Francisco Zen Center is very, concise, to the point. I vow not to slander. So that's pretty straightforward. Tricycle Magazine, I think I found a quote that said, not talking about others' errors or faults, which is in the same realm, I guess. Village Zendo, not discussing the faults of others. And then, you know, there's a few others, but then I did find a quote by, I think it's Bodhidharma. Self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is called the precept of not speaking of the faults of others. I like that one. It's kind of poetic in a way. It's to the point as well. And it also kind of can include, I guess when you talk about not expounding upon error, we start to open it up a little bit. It's not necessarily just about other people, but can be about yourself as well. And then there's my favorite Alien Dogen, who says, in the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Don't permit fault finding. Don't permit haphazard talk. Another quote by him is, not talking about others' errors and faults. In the midst of the Buddha Dharma, we are the same way, the same Dharma, the same realization, the same practice. Do not talk about others' errors and faults. Do not destroy the way. So I like that line, do not destroy the way. He gets a little abstract for me with this as well, in that that we are the same way, that we are the same Dharma. That's hard for me often to see that. I don't quite always understand those statements, but I don't spend a lot of time in the absolute, so there you go. Norman Fisher, who, I really need to reread that book. It's really a good book, I think, and I think the first reading didn't do quite enough justice for it, but he says, in the world could be otherwise, I vow to speak kindly, not to speak ill of others. And so he takes, I think he does what He references the person where he got this idea, but the idea isn't just to speak in negatives about the precepts, but to kind of frame them in terms of a positive as well as maybe a negative. And I think I like that approach because it gives us something to strive for as opposed to something to not do. That's always seems to be more, you know, hopeful. So he goes on to say, at this point of my life, not to speak well of others is painful for me. I just can't do it. I see no point in denigrating anyone. If it's necessary to be critical, I can do that without being unkind. But the truth is, there is far less need to be critical than we think. And further on, he says, context, tone of voice, who is speaking, and who's listening all matter. There is a right and a wrong time to say something, and a good and bad way to say it. Most important is to check the spirit behind our words and to be as loving and harmless as possible. If we see that we don't have a gentle spirit, then we're feeling aggressive and hurt, then maybe we should wait. I think that's just amazing and just super profound. And I guess it touches on right speech and the Eightfold Path a little bit and all that. But yeah, they are, to me, it's a really wonderful way to think about it. And I guess from my own perspective, I don't find myself gossiping or necessarily trash talking people very much. And so I can relate to that feeling of it not feeling good. And if that happens, I know it and I don't feel very good about it. But I also know that I can be pretty harsh and judgmental at times, even though I may not say anything. So there's this whole underlying intention idea, I guess. And while I think our actions and what we do in the world are more important than our thoughts, thankfully, because if we were just judged solely on our thoughts, we'd all be in deep doo-doo. But I think that, you know, intention and somehow focusing on intention is really important because I think that's where it all stems from, essentially. So that was that. And then onward, the Zen Center of LA said something a little different. I will accept what each moment has to offer. This is the practice of not talking about others' errors and faults. I will refrain from talking about others' errors and faults and from encouraging others to do so. I will acknowledge responsibility for everything in my life. So I like that too, because it talks about accountability and it talks a little bit about, again, it's talking about the moment-to-moment experience as opposed to, you know, like, again, like it comes to me, that comes back to the idea that as we're living in the moment, then we can't really be dwelling on mistakes, right? We can't, and it also brings back that question to me about, is it a mistake in the moment, right? Like when does it become a mistake, an action become a mistake? Anyway, so that's kind of neat. And then the Zen peacemakers. And unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer. This is the precept of not talking about others' errors and faults. Similar to the other one. There's the Airuji Zen Center. I vow to realize equality. I will not speak of others' errors and faults. And then the Zen Center of Pittsburgh. A follower of the way does not slander, but rather cultivates and encourages respectful speech. There's only a couple more, but then I have Everyday Zen Foundation, not to speak of others' faults, but to speak out of loving kindness. Stone Creek Zen Center, I vow to refrain from speaking of the faults of others. I vow not to gossip. Very practical, down to earth. Eon Zen says, see the perfection. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. That one's interesting too. The idea of perfection is something I think that we we struggle with. And our definition, at least for me, my definition of perfection is often, well, you know, extreme. It's, but I think I've had this experience in the last, I guess, year maybe, where I really thought about judging myself and others as well from this kind of high sort of lofty standard. And I had this thought one time, and it went something like, well, what if everything happened the way you wanted it to happen and everybody acted the way you wanted it to happen? And I think I said that to myself, and I realized, God, this would be a horrible world to live in. It sounds on the surface like it'd be great, right? Like everything's going your way, but there would be no opportunity for real joy. It would just be you get used to it. Cause the human nature is you get used to whatever it is. It's like gas in a room, right? It fills up the room. You get used to exactly what's happening. And then all of a sudden you take it for granted. So, I've been trying more and more, and I've had some success in just looking at people individually. And I, you know, I can't help but note sometimes when I feel like they fall short, or, you know, this happens, or even myself. But I've found that I'm finding a lot more space to allow that, and also to just say, hey, it's okay, it's great, it's fine, it's actually what makes them human, and actually what makes myself, I'll just talk about me, makes me who I am, right? Like my imperfections are part of, which this talk will be part of, you know, are exactly fine. And so that's, I don't know, I'm kind of rambling a little stuff about. I think the last one I had here was Lion's Roar values. I value, so I like how this starts. I value the perspective that life is one continuous mistake. That's interesting, right? And that even mistakes are grace. So that's a really different interpretation of this precept, but it's, I like that. It's certainly a different slant. So those are kind of like, at least the, I don't know, like a topical survey of what I found on various interpretations. And as you can see there, they vary a little bit here and there. And I was just wondering if there's anything that stands out to anybody in particular, or would, after hearing some of those interpretations, are there ones that you like more than others? Or is there something of value that you got out of any of those kinds of interpretations? Marv, go ahead.
Sorry, Mick was ahead of me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Domio, I guess I took your job. So jump in whenever you think whenever I made him, you know, pick the wrong person or something. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I just wanted to like kind of mention, I really like the Dogen bit that's in the Kyojikaimon about there being one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Because, I mean, I think it's pretty universal that the mistakes that we make are some of the most incredibly instructive things that we can do, right? I mean, I learn more from the mistakes that I make than the times that I don't make mistakes. And, you know, that is the path, right? Like that's the path, that's the realization, that's the practice. I mean, I think Domio had a podcast last week or something about making mistakes in practice. I mean, and I think one of the ways that this precept like sneaks in is that, you know, I look at people and I look at their mistakes. I see them and I don't see them for who they are. You know, I see them for the mistake they made last week or whatever else. And instead of just, you know, accepting that that's just that path, and the path that they are on and the path that I'm on is the same. And it's about making mistakes and learning and, you know, being a different person moment to moment, because we're constantly in flux.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think a little bit about, you know, some of the talk about failure and resiliency and how, you know, mistakes and failure, I think in some ways are similar, and how, you know, to really, I think you have to be pushing those edges a little bit. You know, you have to find that sort of sweet spot of failure and mistakes in order to grow, right? Like, and you have to be resilient to accept those things, I think. And, you know, and that's something that I personally need to work on quite a bit, but, you know, it's, yeah, that's good. I like that a lot. Okay. Whose turn is it, Tomio? Is it Marv's?
Now it's Marv.
Okay, Marv.
In that long list you read, so many of them were about criticizing others or judging others. And what held that together for me a lot, just as a kind of aside, is the chapter, the parable in the Lotus Sutra about the Bodhisattva who never disparages. And the reason for that is because in everybody he meets, no matter what, he sees the future Buddha in them. And if you want to check out a short version, there's a folk song written about it that's just great. Alan Sinoke, who's the present abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, sings it. It's on YouTube. I think it's called Our Hero. And it's an easy way to get the gist of that chapter in about 2 minutes. He didn't write it, but he sings it beautifully.
And the person's name is Allison.
Alan.
Alan.
Sinoke, Sinauke.
Okay, I'll definitely check that out. That's cool.
Our Hero, but I'm not sure.
That's great.
I know.
Jeff, I think you're Jeff, right?
Paulette.
Okay, I thought it was Jeff. I liked what you said about life is one big long mistake. There's so much, there's humor in that, but there's also a lot of self-compassion. And I think you said in the beginning that when you start thinking about, you know, your mistakes and having regret or guilt, that's where you go. I think that's a really good place to go. Because, I mean, what else are you going to do? You're just going to dwell in there and feel terrible. So I liked those two things you said.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Yeah, I think that, for me anyway, the great thing about, well, not the great thing, but, you know, hopefully what comes out of mistakes is the recognition of them, for one, and then also, you know, an acknowledgement and maybe an amends. Maybe there are actions that can be done that can help rectify a situation. And then the beauty of that is, you know, you move on as best you can from there, right? Like it's an action-oriented kind of thing. And if you can't make amends, then at least you can make an apology, right? Which to me is a really different place than a place of shame, where you just, you know, kind of collapse in yourself or whatever. And it's not, shame doesn't generally, it's not a place of positive action, really, for me anyway. So I don't know, I'm making the distinction, I guess, a hard distinction between shame and guilt. But yeah, Jeff, go ahead. I think you're the last one.
Hey, thank you so much, Franklin, for your reflections on this precept and inviting us to be here together with this. As I reflect right now, hearing this precept study about these words, do not dwell on past mistakes. I've certainly spent too much time dwelling on past mistakes, and I think part of that dwelling process is what we're saying, reflecting with certain narratives, certain storylines about me and this thing or this event and what happened. A lot of related assuming that the story I'm telling is absolutely the truth. It's flawless, you know, it's just perfect the way I came up with it. And then part of that dwelling can be just spinning of wheels, not really accomplishing anything and being disconnected from the present. And so then as I think about the next phrases in terms of create wisdom from ignorance, I think about just sitting and letting go of narratives and what I think I know and what I think I understand that feels like it's up here somewhere, and I'm pulling it down and claiming there's a connection between what I know and this thing in the past. But this encouragement to create wisdom from ignorance is kind of inviting me to just let go of all that and be present right now and to just sit non-thinking. So there's a couple of thoughts I'm having in the moment, and thanks again to this group for being together.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jeff. That's good. I you're talking got me thinking about one of the things I've struggled with is some regret, and regret really more almost grief over lost time. You know, I'm getting to be an older guy now, and you know, and I think, and I look back to various periods of my life, and I realize I'm not going to get those back. And there was a certain amount of time that was wasted, and it isn't necessarily a self-critical kind of thing. It's really more like I just am grieving it, like grieving those times. And so that's an interesting distinction between like dwelling on mistakes and living in grief, and like where is that line drawn? Anyway, that's just something that came to mind, something that I've struggled with myself over, I guess in my recovery. I'm in recovery as well as some others in the Sangha, and so that there's a certain amount of you know, obvious regret and obvious grief over some of those events and time. So well, let's see, we got about 12 minutes, and I think I'm actually gonna finish soon. So the last section, there was a couple quotes I found, and this I think probably has to do with, I'm gonna shut my door real quick. Some people, I think. This goes back to what I originally talked about with regards to evolutionary psychology and things like that. And Sharon Saltzman talks about, and this is a quote from her, in my research for the book, I'm not sure which book she's talking about, but I've encountered extensive information about evolutionary biology and specifically about the phrase negativity bias. This concept refers to the fact that our nervous systems are programmed on an evolutionary level to look for possible negative outcomes in our surroundings. Our job as living creatures is to spot imminent danger and any sense of threat in our surroundings. Looking for negativity in our lives is literally a survival mechanism dating back to the times when we were actually required to protect ourselves from being killed by predators. Given that most of us probably have no need to measure ourselves against the potential threat of a tiger or bear, we simply become lost in this pattern of dwelling on negativity, which includes more and more fixation on our own failings and inadequacy. And I'm going to add, not to mention the failings and inadequacy of others. So I find that really interesting. And I think Daniel's talked about this book. I read this book as well, called Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. And he's an evolutionary psychologist / Buddhist. And there's this really fascinating book. So if anybody's kind of into that kind of stuff, and how Buddhism, I think, in a way, is a response to some of the sort of hardwired evolutionary ways of approaching survival that we've created for, you know, that we've really haven't created. They've kind of existed before our prefrontal cortex developed. It's a really fascinating book. So I really heartily recommend it. But this got me also thinking, okay, well, that's fine. So we're so critical, but what about slander or criticism, you know, of others? And is there an evolutionary context for that? And I think there is, if we think about it. So I think in a way, you know, negative talk or slander about others could be considered a way to elevate our own social status at the expense of others. So in my mind, it's not hard to imagine a time, you know, when where higher status within a tribe, for example, would help in finding mates and propagating, you know, our gene pool. Even today's social status is often associated with increased reproductive options, for lack of a better word. So fortunately, these strategies are not the whole story, since it is not a zero-sum game in terms of finding mates and partners. Today, finding a partner is much more multifaceted process than just finding the best candidate for reproduction. So obviously, there are plenty of people that don't have children and don't need to have children and have wonderful, happy relationships. So what else is going on? I mean, what is there some other purpose that we can think of that slander or just talking negatively about people, you know, serves? And so that's kind of an open question. And if anybody has any response, that's great. Or any thoughts on that area? Like, why do we find a need to slander? Mark?
I think it's a more general observation, but I noticed that feeling like I have something all figured out is reassuring. It's a stress and anxiety reduction behavior. So even though it's not fun to write someone off, it may be less stressful and less anxiety inducing than admitting that you don't know about them.
That's interesting. Yeah. Shiketsu, did you change your mind?
No, I don't know what happened to my...
Your hand went away. Luckily, your real one's still there, I think.
Yeah, right. It's interesting that I've always looked at this precept, do not dwell on past mistakes, create wisdom from ignorance, as a personal thing, as something having only to do with myself, not with other people, and not talking about it. It's nothing to do with others. Maybe because I've always been self-critical and self-conscious in my earlier years, but and I hear a lot of talk about dwelling on mistakes of other people, and that's, for me, it never enters that realm. It's just dwell on my own past mistakes. You know, sort of take care of my own home.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I find there's a relationship of, for myself anyway, between self-criticism and how much I'm involved in that and judgment and all that. It seems to translate to other people as well. So when I'm more accepting of myself and more less critical of myself, I seem to be less critical of others and more accepting of others too. So I think it's all related, to be honest, in some way. Not exactly sure if that's true for everybody, but it's certainly true for me.
No, without a doubt, it's true for me too. But
yeah. Okay, well, I think that's about all I have. Is there any more pages here? Nope.
So Franklin, I don't know if this is opening a can of worms too late, but I wanted to, throw out, you know, that, I mean, I definitely, look, I don't talk about y'all, but in my past, especially as people said, like when I'm upset, when I feel threatened, then, you know, I've find a good friend to go on and on and on about this person and how unreasonable they're being, and talk about a narrative, right? All about this person and how they're, you know, out to get me, or they're inherently flawed and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, in the Buddhist teachings, sometimes it seems to imply that we should never do that. And I wonder about when it's just useful or important to vent. I don't think like Buddhism admits that anywhere. But I know in my experience, it's like, when is it okay? Like, I don't know what I would do if I couldn't sometimes, you know, with a friend be honest about frustrations and talk about something like that. So I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. It's like, when do we know it's, you know, it's kind of okay, it's venting, and when it goes into.
Yeah. I think that's a really tough line to draw, right? I mean, maybe that's why Buddhism doesn't directly talk about it, because, like, you know, there's venting, which I totally understand. I think we all need to do that at times. And then there's somebody in somewhere, one of the, I think it was probably Norman Fisher, was talking about, or maybe it was the wholehearted way, this idea that if you're saying something that you wouldn't be willing to say to somebody else, like about that person, if you're not willing to say to their face, then it's probably more than venting. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you've crossed into slander land, I guess. I don't know.
I wonder what, Ruth Ann, were you unmuting yourself to say something?
Yes. You know, we have this time when fact gets to be muted in some ways or diluted, but to vent about what's going wrong with just a fact about our local environment that we're speaking out about with, as I say, some facts, maybe some science behind it. And that's venting, and I need to find the right platform for it. I'm speaking for myself, either someone in the legislature, or even if it's just a message on governor's phone machine. But we have that capacity. I mean, it's in our language for a reason, and slander is, you know, there are times when that happens, but overall, I take Norman Fisher's attitude about there's no reason to criticize anybody. But if we're speaking of deliberate actions that we have reason to protest as citizens on the planet, I think it's worth it to vent, even if no one's listening on the street corner. So, but I think these words, like guilt is junk food emotion, but if it pushes us to do something further, I guess that's okay. And regret is part of our lives, but we can sit with compassion for each one of us. Thank you, Franklin and Domio.
Thank you, Ruthie. So I think it's 9. Yep. And I don't have anything more, so take it away, Domio.
All right. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
I just want to thank you all for being a great sangha to do this presentation with and contributing, helping me out. Otherwise, it would have gone a lot faster.
Thanks, Franklin.
Thanks, Franklin.
Thank you, Franklin.
Thank you, Franklin. You're welcome.
Enjoyed it. I recommend it to anybody who hasn't done it yet. So.
Bye. Sweet dreams.
Good night, everybody.